Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic Effects. Welcome back. It's been a hectic few days. I've attended a conference of sorts and presented some ideas about what's referred to globally as observant masonry. You fellows that are familiar with continental masonry will not be at all impressed by it, I think, because it is picking up the manner of that Masons interact in some of the major Grand Lodges in Europe. Just a more depth, a more intelligent conversation beyond scratching the surface and going through the mechanics, you know, that type of thing. But where I am, that's been the stock and trade of masonry for, well, closing in on 160 years. Then the essence is certainly the externalities, the performance. But I have to, in all fairness, I can rationalize that. But I don't hesitate to suggest that it was only a very, very small part of the core of masonry. And it established a mindset that is based on fitting in, adapting the thinking to an instruction that is in itself quite incomplete. And so here we have an expression of our attempt at critical thinking about the craft, and not at the craft, but through it. Often wondered if we realize about that, you know, in where I am particularly, and perhaps where you are, that there's a changing subjectiveness about masonry. When the values of the order come to us, whether it's, you know, by happenstance or by good hard work on our part, it always occurred to me that there's different things we can do with. There's different expressions of that. We can, you know, you've probably seen men that are just very quite interesting fellows and have absorbed the values and are living what I would say comparatively about values-based life. And then I meet other men that take those values as a launch pad, that they begin to inform ideas and ways of connecting with the community around them. And I find great, you know, great satisfaction in that as well. I find the Mason that what do we call the knife and fork of Mason? I think that it's often referred to. The dark side of that we could say it's all happiness and play, but it's also an anecdote for depression and sadness and isolation. It's one thing for the likes of me to be alone or enjoying my time or reading, absolutely, and or you not wanting to be interrupted, absolutely. it's another thing to feel lonely. And this is that's very, I think, quite destructive in a way. Now, I'm not talking about the men that deserve to be alone. You know, does anybody? Well, yes, there's people that are unfit, and there's people that need to find that isolation to work through their whatever their issues or baggage or, you know, points of reference, maladaptive kinds of ideas. They take the time, but. there's nothing proscriptive about masonry. That's one of the interesting things. Perhaps all you need is a man needs a walk, just a few minutes alone to collect his own thoughts, or in the middle of the day, for people that have an awareness of meditation. It's not necessary, as we know, it's not necessarily sitting in a lotus position in a room with a joss stick burning. No. There's different forms of meditations, as we know. But in that moment, it doesn't give you a reset in a way. A reset, a cleansing in a way, or as one of my dear colleagues used to talk about, just emptying the mind. And it's such an interesting, if you haven't ever tried it, you know, in your private moments, you can certainly, it's interesting. To do it and knowing that, being so aware that when you're feeling tugged at, when you're feeling distressed or, you know, confused or undone by, to use that as a reset. But like everything, you know, it's I know some men use this as leverage. It's another form of too much testosterone in the room. You know, I'm dominant. Somehow I'm bettering you, not because I'm driving the Maybach and parking that or the Rolls, but because I have this sense of virtue that you don't. It gives me a sense of superiority in some way. Yeah, we see that, but I'm not talking about that type of neuroses. I'm talking about the sincere fella. Listeners can take my word for it. When I find that overbearing type, I tend to avoid them. Like, I just very quietly, I just don't prefer that company, and I don't tolerate it. I just find it too meaningless. The men that I have around, that I consider good and decent people are men that exhibit that sense of sincerity. I don't seem to need much from the people around me. Sincerity, I prefer people struggling with that sense of authenticity, you know. And I just so love the engagement, you know, the fellas that just wanted to get into the discussion and press back and forth, exchange ideas. I just find that, you know, wonderful. That's, doesn't get any better than that. And then it fits, I think, with the flow of this show. I am so happy to call it. I don't feel, if sometimes I feel negligent about the show and the ideas that we try to pack into it. But you know, the endorsement, the encouragement comes from you, from listeners. Particularly, you know, I'll go, and then sometimes I feel a bit negligent. I think, well, these guys probably like to be acknowledged like anybody does, but I don't think that that's why they tune into this show. But nevertheless, at the risk of being impolite, please accept my gratitude. Listeners from the United States and Canada have been legion. They've been just been there for ever. And Britain, can you imagine? I never did expect that any one topic would fascinate the world permanently. you know, like, get over that, eh, man? I never did, but I try to work on themes and things that have some meaning and leave them with you. And it is a big step to think that listeners would be the kind of people that would be sitting in a cafe with me, and we'd be talking about these. We'd be talking, meeting, and then we would gradually just slide into this kind of a conversation, not with an agenda or anything so abstract as that, but just comfortably fall into these conversations. And I think of you listeners like that. But you, a foolish old person that I am, I think that what we're doing is okay, with the added appeal of this pretty interesting technology. Mm-hmm. That we're doing what was the start of masonry, 14th century? I don't say masonry in the formalized administrative sense. No, I'm thinking about masonry as a quality of a value. There were men like us, people like us, that enjoyed thoughtful conversation, intelligent conversation. We didn't do it, and we still don't, because we want people to think of us that way. It's like, so you go with them. You know, they've got their own conversations, but these are things that we enjoy. And we happen, by some good design, some grand design, to be Freemasons, and it gave us reason to pull together. Not necessarily whether we're wearing an apron, but the values, the principles, the ideas of masonry. Now, I don't want to seem like I'm taking advantage or I'm being in any sense disloyal to regular Freemasonry. It's certainly not my intent. But I often think, how does this fit into with the world? Well, Masonry is that medicine that scientists created to help people, and then rather than patent it and try and profit from this miracle, they gave it to the world. They gave it to the world. Mm-hmm. And out of respect for that, hardworking men and men of position realized that these ideas elevated the human condition. At least within us, and started to build those started to build those monuments as mnemonic, not as competition with religions no, not at all, but an expression of permanence, perhaps, and the gravity of thinking. Not as an imposition, but as an acknowledgement. It's one of many, many mindsets and ways of thinking about life. But it is here, and it would exist without the buildings and without the ornaments and without the protocols, the way we greet and acknowledge one another. It would. But we're social creatures, and we like to communicate, and we've made these arrangements amongst ourselves, and it was forward thinking. It was the kind of thinking that lent itself to a global or universal approach to masonry. Can you imagine how the audacity of this group? not really knowing that we've measured every or counted every head, but knowing that the world is huge. It's very, very, and we're very, very small in the universe, in the scheme of things. And to think, imagine, that there are like-minded individuals around the world. And wouldn't it be interesting if we began to talk about shared values, these values of honor and respect and brotherhood and justice and compassion, and asserting that men everywhere of different politics and different cultures and different religions share these values in common. Oh my, can you imagine the chaos that would happen around the world if that kind of attitude just got out there? I'm still not sure why we have a fascination with the gender bias thing. I don't know how many hundreds of years do we have to toil over the same kind of trivia. See, that's me. Imagine. And then for you and I, 21st century, here we are, finding our own way, reinterpreting these values, but connecting with this really, really interesting history. This backstop. Now, how many of us go around talking like this? Or who is, you know, if you're fortunate, you have a partner in your life that, I start off with these excited, brilliant ideas, watching her eyes glaze over. She's very, very polite. And then I realize, you know, yes, dear, okay, this is absolutely meaningless. This is like talking to her about my favorite fly, you know, or the new adventures in the fishing tackle. Like, you know, I confess I'm that kind of clown. But I talked to you today, and I think we're relatively successful as a couple because of the kind of things that you exhibit with your lodge members, or you seek them out. That constant sense of compromise, you know, to make it work, to make any relationship work, to feel good about it. Now, I want you to be my first violin, and I want the conductor to, of course, you have that relationship with the music and the conductor and with the core. And I want you to feel that acknowledgement. You have to, we're there. We have a huge orchestra, 126 pieces. I don't know, what are we playing? Tchaikovsky, okay. And what piece? I'll leave that to your imagination. And the music is incomplete if one of us is not at our station with our particular instrument. And oh my goodness, is it that everybody needs to be playing everything all the time? What piece of music are you listening to? That kind of thinking is the sound of the wind. You know, it's there. And sometimes it's very faint. But when we're trying to harmonize and create that music, we all have that agreement. We've had, call it compromise if you have to. Let's just presume we're all terribly narcissistic. We all know better than everybody in the world. We know the best music. We know the best timing. We know the best venue, the best conductor. It's all about me, me, me. Well, sadly, that's delusional. And if I am, if one of the listeners out there is a conductor, my goodness, what a privilege to have you with us. Acknowledgement, maestro. Yes, by all means. They call it compromise then, or call it a willingness. What do you do with that whole term? I'll talk about that constant compromise. But when you're sitting in the orchestra and the house is just full and everybody is resplendent and beautiful, and there's that sense of anticipation, you know, you remember, and you've heard the buzz, you've heard the the subdued energy, and then it's silence, isn't it? And the first beat. Now think about it. Is that, at that moment, is compromise going through your head? Nah, I don't think so. I don't think you would be there if the thoughts of a player were that meager. I think you're there because it is splendid. It is, you're part of elegance. You're part of that sophistication. You're part of history, 126 people performing this moment. And what do I do when you finish? I'm on my feet. Oh, my goodness. I'm tears in my eyes. I'm thrilled beyond words. I'm transformed, and you've been part of it. That's the craft for me. And that's, I think, if you're looking for a model of the compromise in Freemasonry, you could be meager. I know there's men like that. Me, and I know better. That guy's a bit of a whatever. But that's not the lodges that are accomplishing the potential of Masonry. I want that connection with you, and to feel that compromise is given in the context of that beautiful expression, the beautiful performance. And when you are together, when you see each other thereafter on the street, what do you do? You greet each other. Oh, my. Do you remember that night? Do you remember that performance? Do you remember when I forgot my wand? You know, yeah. I almost missed the call. I was busy on the phone. It was with my children. You know, I just messed up. You know, we hear those beautiful anecdotes of Pavarotti talking about that. It's like, oh my goodness, oh, foolish of Pavarotti. Not at all. Human. We are human. And to do it all the time, we don't do it just once in a while or four or five performances in a season. We become that familiar with this, the beauty of the compromise required in the exchange, and knowing that, and we're intelligent enough to know that everybody in the room is doing the same thing, and to appreciate when it really sparkles, when we just see it. We don't see the result. We don't see it as, oh my goodness, everybody's compromising. Nobody thinks that way. It's like, where in the world did that sound come from? Did you imagine? It's breathtaking, and all of a sudden it's silent, you know, the space between the notes, and she's there with her bassoon, and it just brings everybody breathless to the next measure, and that measure is you. Masonry, beautiful. Yes, I think we have a pretty interesting show today. I'm going to plunge, Bull in the China Shop, leaving romantic poetry behind, not love and hugs kind of romanticism, but that period around Enlightenment when we were looking at nature and our place in nature and the expression of emotion. No, we didn't do this, what's referred to as modernism. Oh, my goodness. I know it's scary stuff. Scary for me. T.S. Eliot, John Ashbery, and Christian Hockley, that kind. Not looking for, you know, anything more than furthering the idea, the value, the worth of poetry itself. The music, well, you know. This show does look from having these great big honking speakers that you're carrying around with you and massive headphones. You know, now we have, you know, this just exquisite sound. And I, like you, I'm telling myself, I like that scratch and itch of vinyl. I like that pop. I need that. That makes me feel good. It's like having amplifiers with tubes. It's just so much different. Well, maybe it is. And sometimes you get it, and other times I just like that clarity, you know, that separation. Here, is there anything that we can, you know, this is just embarrassing. We're living in such beautiful times, just incredible times. So I think it's we need to that the history, well, you know, it's hopefully it's still safe. You know, we want to think about it's like rhetoric. We want to be able to deal with these very challenging roles and thinking, but not deteriorate into that cloud of insult and offense, you know, that kind of childishness, immaturity. We're taking that up another step. We want to examine our ideas. We want to know the mind of our opposition, of opposing points of view. And then the push, always the push. So the push of the ideas. Let's enjoy a bit of time together and see what might happen. It's in another people day together, and I think we'll be quite happy with the result, don't you? Here, something by Hank Mobley to kick it off. Sit back, relax. Like that. Thank you. Hank Mobley, but his fans will already know that. Beautiful. Beautiful. Commentary time. This is entitled The Isolation of Understanding. Just thinking that, you know, that feeling you have when you begin to understand, when you have an understanding of what's going on behind the surface layer. And it's not, and it is what it is. It's not sugar-coated. It's not glorious, although sometimes it can be. You begin to see the subtlety of some people. And that's a trust. You want to keep that to your, you want to be able to not be so obvious and awkward about that. Just, there's a grace to it. No, I'm talking about understanding the greater truths, the struggle that goes on. And it's not, I don't even know if it's an anecdote, you know. Positivism, anything negative is wrong, anything negative, except without that, nothing really stands up. Unless we have some kind of opposing forces or it's almost as if I want to erase the sense of probability from existence, or the fates, or the result of a calculation further than my mathematics, that kind of thing. What to do when you know? Well, people might look at you and say, "Oh, you're a wonderful object. We will all strive for that. We want to join you underneath the tree, looking out with that serenity. We want to understand what the achievement, how do you deal with it?" But it is a matter of values. Do you look at it in horror and say, "Oh my goodness, this is terrible because I'm seeing what's really going on. I'm seeing the struggle." Or do you say the struggle is part of nature? It's part of it all. our struggle, the sort constant sorting and that recalibration and the, you know, think about the different chemistries that happen when just a random group of people are in the room and with notions of what needs to happen in there. Well, you know what that happens with that. Sometimes it doesn't go as planned. But to know that truth and to be able to think outside of it in your own reverie, to in your own mind, nobody else knows. It's that conversation that we have with ourselves, that commune with our better nature and our understanding and learning that it's good. It's a good thing to know and to understand. The building is beautiful, right? What you've created is absolutely marvelous. But it's on sand or there's a crack in that material. I've noticed some stress points that don't seem to... What about the engineering here? You know, that seems a little... Oh, but the design is just incredible. And yes, it's knowing that maybe there's, you know... And if there's a risk, of course, we bring it up with, you know, what about that? Not, I suppose we can get legal and say, oh, you're a terrible person. We're going to yank your license. You're irresponsible. Or we can say, what about that? This is what was part of the thinking behind this article here, the isolation of understanding. Now, if I burst into flames here, you know, so be it. Wouldn't be the first time. What do you do with the truth? Does it find a person or does a person find truth? Our tendency is to put a brave face on everything. It's called positivity, the new upper hand, the new moral dominance in the contest. Still better, more than willing and able to communicate in case anyone within earshot might help us by taking us out of our solitude. The aha moment is a menace. In a world high on piety, we have allowed versions of the truth, versions that satisfy the sense of being more clever than the rest, except for the fact that these little minds don't use their gift to contribute to anything. They're driven by honesty, that, and a disregard of their own advancement. Why, then, do some of us find it is best to know the truth about a person than live under an illusion, including ourselves? Isn't there a risk of paranoia, suspecting everybody is on the game? Just another excuse to avoid something we just don't want to do or think or say. Is that the point? Is there a point? Do old men reach a point, disappointments mount up, and then they find more reasons to enjoy their own company? Me, I prefer even a casual encounter with a trustworthy person. The world doesn't need rose-colored glasses, and with that said, we begin noticing all the rest. There is so much more to life, to reason, than the manipulations of silly people. The elegance of nature, the thrill of being able to find what the painter or poet wanted to impose, wanted to say. Joy, no longer as an out-of-mind experience, but because with so much of life being illusion, one finds an ability to deeply and truly appreciate beauty without trying to masquerade. Philosophy, context, being, and understanding, there is beauty. Find those moments when you are with the right people to share an exchange of ideas. Those are special moments with special people. Masonry, masonry has been making them easier to find for hundreds of years. Our good fortune, my goodness. Better than, I was having a little bit of a difficulty with that whole sense of being subordinated by the group think, needing to constantly fit in. I much prefer talking to you about your ideas, your values, your ways. Coleman Hawkins? Why not? Thank you. How about this? We've been reminded about the poetry helping us to express and identify deeper emotion and thinking. But when you think about it, it doesn't seem like it. I don't turn to the morning paper and look for the poetry corner anymore. It's just not there. It's as if, our collective consciousness is just, unconsciousness is just erased the need for that. We know everything that we need to know is on the surface in front of us. I translate it according to this need to fit in with the flow of people walking down the street to their offices in the morning. As long as I have that mindset, that groupthink, if you will, that I'm perfectly fine. And so should you be. Stop asking impertinent questions of us. I was troubled in a way. I wanted to, poetry has always been for us, a reminder. It's that there is more going on around than the quick glance would allow us. And for you, it might well be a reminder that all that we see is not necessarily what is. We look beyond in our effort to understand what's going on. We look beyond. Like it's like the eyewitness. You know, everything was eyewitness, and then. Now we even have devices, and I'm not sure how I feel about this. A little device that will videotape your life, everything, every comment, every interaction. Isn't that interesting? Wow. We're looking at the fellow you walk along with us, a whole crowd of us. And we see something out there and somebody stops and somebody sees something else. Maybe it's the sunrise or it's the waves against the, or maybe it is nature. Maybe it is a butterfly in the city. Who knows? It could be anything. And they're alerted to a different connection that becomes a symbol of another story, a different kind of story. So we're moving here, boldly moving beyond a poetic romanticism into this post-romantic or modernist period. My goodness, how risky can it be? The poet that I want to talk to you about today is T.S. Eliot. We've had him on the show before. But this is kind of an interesting piece, I think, and we want to know here. This is from his work, The Four Quartets. You can find this references to this, and they were published over a 6-year period. Interesting guy, interesting man, and lots to criticize if that's what you're prone to do. You want to. Wash your hands and say, no, we don't want that kind of person around us. Well, plenty of fuel for your fire here. But he also had an interesting mind. He was an artist that it's like when you go to an art gallery, do you squeeze your eyes tight and shut and walk past the cubism exhibits? Is that I know I'm probably laughing out of turn, and I'll be paying for this with some level of damnation. This is very briefly. The first poem we're going to get into is the first poem of what's called the Four Quartets, and it's called Burnt Norton, and it was. And then he did East Coker, The Dry Salvages, and Little Gidding. And these were written during World War II and the air raids in Great Britain. And they were first published. This guy became a British citizen, of course. And they were first published by Faber and Faber in Great Britain between 1940 and 42. I only say that because it gives you a bit of context, a little bit of the history of what was going on. They interlinked meditations with the common theme of of being man's relationship with time, the universe, and the divine. Well, I'm thinking with the nightmare that was being visited on the world, these would probably be worthwhile thoughts, like, what the hell is going on? And, oh, that was then, and it's not, and we're past that, and now we've learned the hard way, and we won't repeat that. I wish we repeat it, because we're a whole new generation of people, and that history means different things to different people. So in this poetry, Eliot blends his Anglo-Catholicism with mystical and philosophical and poetic works from the Eastern and Western religions. And he has references to the Bhagavad Gita and the pre-Socratics and St. John of the Cross and Julian of Norwich. So so here, look at it before the critics get at it and get at you. One of his notable critics was George Orwell, who argued that religion was not a worthy topic for Eliot's poems. Later critics disagreed with Orwell's claims about the poems and argued instead that the religious themes made the poem stronger. So overall, the reviews of the poem within Great Britain were favorable, while reviews in the United States were split between those who liked his later style and those who felt he had abandoned positive aspects of his earlier poetry. Now, the first of the quartets is named for a ruined country house in Gloucestershire. And that quartet is the most explicitly concerned with time as an abstract principle. And the first section combines the hypothesis on time, that the past and the future are always contained in the present. This is something that I subscribe to. That's why memory brings everything to the present right in front of us. But it's always available to us in the present. And then there's a description of a rose garden where children hide and they're laughing, and a bird serves as the poet's guide, bringing him into the garden and showing him around and saving him from despair and not being able to reach the laughing children. And the second section begins with a sort of song, and it's filled with abstract images of a vaguely pagan flavor. I'm not going to get through the entire poem today. That would be more to eat up a little bit more time, but I will give you an aperitif. You can choose to follow up. T.S. Eliot with one T, the four quartets, and this is the first one, Burnt a Notion, and I think it works. This is the first part of the first notion of time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future, and time future contained in time past. I would rather we were sitting down having a drink with the guy while he's doing this one. Okay. Time present and time past are both perhaps present and time future. If all time is eternally present, all time is unredeemable. What might have been is an abstraction, remaining a perpetual possibility. Only in a world of speculation, what might have been and what has been point to one end, which is always present. Footfalls echo in the memory down the passage which we did not take toward the door we never opened into the rose garden. My words echo thus in your mind, but to what purpose? Disturbing the dust in a bowl of rose leaves, I do not know. Other echoes inhabit the garden. Shall we follow? Quick, said the bird, find them round the corner through the first gate into that first world. Shall we follow the deception of the thrush into our first world? There they were, dignified and visible, moving without pressure over the dead leaves in the autumn heat through the vibrant air, and the bird called in response to the unheard music hidden in the shrubbery, and the unseen eye beam crossed, for the roses had the look of flowers that are looked at. There. They were as our guests, accepting and accepted. So we moved, and they, in a formal pattern, along the empty alley into the box circle it took down, into the drained pool. dry the pool, dry concrete, brown edged, and the pool was filled with water out of sunlight. And the lotos rose quietly, quietly. The surface glittered out of a heart of light. And they were behind us, reflected in the pool, when a cloud passed. And the pool was empty, containing laughter. Go, 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 said the bird. Humankind cannot bear very much reality. Time past and time future. What might have been and what has been point to the end, which is always, always present. What do you think? Does it work? That's the first portion of that. Benny Carter, how dare you? Gorgeous, seductive, isn't it? Do you mind if we if we talk a bit about history, just safe history, not our history. My goodness, it's far too cumbersome, but history is a backstop. And where you are, from your point of view, I'm sure, I'm confident that there are other, that there are other scholars in your background that speak to these issues. And particularly, we're looking through, you know, through the lens of time, and we're looking at these, the what the secretaries wrote about the different lodges and the, and aristocracy and the sense of masonry and the consideration that one lodge was doing it right and the others obviously were doing it wrong. Pardon me. This is a, so that's just to bring you up to speed a little bit. We're still fussing around, you know, 18th century stuff, 1780s kind of thing. So French Revolution was still ahead of us. American Revolution. Okay. You have the sense that of what's happening. And what was happening, that doesn't even come close to what was happening in Greece at the time. Everywhere you were sitting, where you are, history was moving forward during this period in some way, shape, or form. It depends really on your perspective. What it is that if you're looking for, you have a question, you're looking for an explanation, history, how far, how deep your learning is, may give you a resolution to that. So we're going to talk a bit here about our Cartesian man. So I'll just give you a little heads up for those, like if you're like me, I need a brush up. It's the philosophical and scientific system of René Descartes. You had that one. And it was developed by other 17th century thinkers, François de la Barre and Nicolas Malebranche and Baruch Spinoza. Yeah, so worth our attention, I think. And Descartes is often regarded as the first thinker to emphasize the use of reason to develop the natural sciences. Now, I know what you're going to say. Reason does not, is not the panacea, it does not explain everything. But I will say it explains an awful lot. For him, philosophy was a thinking system that embodied all knowledge. So, well, name dropping, okay? This is perfect. St. Augustine, Aristotle, yeah, yes. Cogito argument, you know. Additionally, there's a similarity between Descartes' work and the Scottish philosopher George Campbell's in 1776, titled The Philosophy of Rhetoric. Worth a look, if you don't mind me saying. But Cartesians view the mind as being wholly separate from the corporeal body. Sensation and the perception of reality are thought to be the source of untruth and illusions. With the only reliable truths to be had in the existence of a metaphysical mind. Now, obviously, you and I need to sit back and talk about that. I'm not sure about that, are you? And I would love to hear your perspective, yes? Such a mind can perhaps interact with a physical body, but it does not exist in the body, nor even in the same physical plane as the body. The question of how mind and body interact would be a persistent difficulty for Descartes and his followers, with different Cartesians providing different answers. And so to this point, Descartes wrote, we should conclude from all this that those things which we conceive clearly and distinctly as being diverse substances, as we regard mind and body to be, are really substances essentially distinct from one from the other. And this is the conclusion of the sixth meditation. Yeah, I didn't say this is all going to be explained in a paragraph, did I? And so we can see mind and body are indeed separate. You know, those are the variables here today. And because they can be separated from each other, as Descartes postulates, the mind is a whole inseparable from itself, while the body can become separated from itself to some extent, as when one loses an arm or leg. Very pleasant, very pleasant. Coupled with the claim to virtue could also be the claim that the Freemason was the rationalist, in effect, the Cartesian man. Thus, although avowedly Christian, Le Candeur could be champion rationalism as that which distinguished the Freemason from the profane. I like to subscribe to that. Once again, as was standard in Masonic rhetoric, the profane are watching the lodge, or so the orator in La Candura tells us. Indeed, he continues, in the time of Lord Derterwetter, Grand Master in the 1740s, it was said that our assemblies proclaimed an estrangement from women. In the face of these charges, Freemasons adopted aristocratic women as their patrons. Get the point? Counterpoint. In the face of these charges, Freemasons adopted aristocratic women as their patrons. Incensed by the slanders of the profane, the order goes on and paints the portrait of its new patroness. The character, which is a sweet nature, has embellished by a cultivated spirit, such as the nobility of sentiments, the goodness of the soul, the righteousness of heart, and the equality of character, the charm of her society, the sweetness of Moors. Cultivated virtue and nobility of the soul, these are the values praised by the orator. Then, effortlessly, he proclaims that these virtues reside in the new patron of Le Candeur, the Baroness de Flochland, whose husband is a member of the lodge. She is addressed as a sister. Her protection is sought, and thus begins the lodge of adoption that ran parallel to Le Candeur. She has offered homage from the ambience of the moment, conjures up the remnants of chivalry as much as it does the patronage of saints. If true nobility could now also be symbolically feminized, access to the equality of all brothers nevertheless remains limited. In her response, the Baroness graciously accepts, and she identifies with, quote, "the virtues that you practice, despite the impenetrable veil that hides you from my sex." The implication is that some mysteries will continue to be hidden despite the virtues of the Baroness. Point made. We're looking at 18th century. How is it that where I am, we seem to have stepped back in this conversation? We seem to be lost. It's like our little, you know, Bob Fosse jazz hands. We don't want to talk about that. It's too complicated for our little male minds. Oh my goodness. So here, what would you like? Would you like a little, maybe a little bit of today, beautiful day around me, a lovely way to spend an evening. This is Curtis Fuller. I think you'll see if I nailed it. Pleasure being with you today. Thank you for pulling up your chair and relaxing with us for a little bit and thinking about some things on that Masonic orbit of the world and way of, our way of thinking about the world. If We've entertained, then excellent. If we've informed, even better, my goodness. But what we long for is the next part, to actually talk amongst each other. So find your mates, you know, talk with your confidants. And each time you do, you will learn something more about yourself and about the world around. We're an ongoing project. Next week, I don't know if we'll tackle the idea of changing subjectiveness in masonry. That might be something interesting. In the meantime, it's not enough to say the world needs stability. The world has stability. We just don't recognize it. We do have virtue. We just don't recognize that. We do have values that are often overridden because of somebody that speaks a little higher volume, drove past a crowd of flag wavers yesterday saying rude things about our government here. That expression is an expression of freedom. As much as it pains me to say, the reality is when people have been repressed for a long time and they are given this expression of freedom, they're going to use it. Then I think that's a natural kind of an outcome. But to think that they've already mastered that expression of freedom is silly. It's like saying you know how to ride a bike when you first look at it. Well, you don't. Or that you know how to master flight just by looking at a helicopter. No, we need to be able to exchange experience. And who are we to say, well, our experience is the cat's pajamas. You know, this is the way life ought to be. So people are going to use and abuse and overstep and experiment with these newfound powers. And I think that we can deny it. We can not necessarily like what's going on. But it is an expression of something very, very strong and powerful in the world. We're not afraid of a dissenting opinion. Are there limits? Oh, yes. And does law sit down with philosophers to examine those limits? Oh, yes. And are we involved in that? We can be. And are we moving further and further toward universalism, the universal form of Masonic value? Cautiously. We've been sold the bill of goods, and humanity has been sold the bill of goods at different times. You know, this is the way. If everybody drinks the Kool-Aid, it's going to be a wonderful world. We've seen that through history. We can examine those efforts. We've had despots and monarchs, and we've had all kind of theocracies try it, and we see that partially they solve the riddle of harmony for a small group of people, but we're looking for, my goodness, it's like any fool can go and slaughter their opponents. Like, you know, big, you know, is that what you want to be known for? You know, you think there's some aggrandizement and ruthlessness? Well, that's not exactly, you know, that's pretty reptilian if you don't mind. But who's going to tackle the big picture, the big, you know, what brings us together? And the harmony where we do find it, metaphorically, we put down our guard and trust each other. Well, I'm afraid that masonry seems to be checking, you know, fitting that bill in some ways. I don't like to admit that it's ahead of its time, you know, we don't want to do that. But it does have some properties that are worth exploring. I hope I see you again here. In a few days, and in the meantime, you know, we are performative, so commit those acts of random Masonic kindness, the randomness. And if you can do that, if a man can do that without drawing attention to the fact that it was him, that it was his generosity, but leaving the world to wonder, if you look at that whole group, one of them did this act of generosity, and it could be any one of them. Is it the guy that's dressed like a bum that is philanthropic? Is it that guy that needs a haircut? or is it somebody that just seems not to be what they are, seems confused? We'll never know. That's the beauty of the craft, eh? Master the ego. No, don't let death do that. Master the ego. I'll see you again real soon. Thanks. It's been fun.